people who have grow crops there. So they, people are helping them with their own resources.
Well, thank you so much, Juan Carlos, and I'm so glad, Juan, that you were able to reach your sister as well. That does it for our broadcast. Go to democracynow.org for transcripts, video and audio podcasts. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KVU Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KVU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KVU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
We're good.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'll start from the top.
Yeah.
All right. You're on. Coming up on KBOO Evening News, beloved singer-songwriter Tom Petty was formally pronounced dead last night after cardiac arrest.
The U.S. voted down a resolution paving the way for state-sanctioned executions to censure speech, restrict civil freedoms, and undermine same-sex relationships.
House Speaker Paul Ryan withdraws a bill that was introduced last month designed to ease restrictions on gun silencers. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 3rd, 2017. I'm Kyle Carrezzi.
And I'm Jasmine Moneymaker. Many people are in mourning today over the death of music icon Tom Petty. From his 1985's breakthrough hit Refugee to the 2006 rockabilly-influenced Saving Grace, Tom Petty created some of the best music of modern times. Petty was born in Gainesville, Florida on October 20, 1950. At the age of 10, he met Elvis Presley on the set of the film Follow That Dream and soon developed an interest in rock and roll. After seeing the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, Petty knew he wanted to be in a band. In 1976, he got together with guitarist Mike Campbell, keyboard player Beaumont Trench, bassist Ron Blair, and drummer Stan Lynch to form The Heartbreakers. In November of that year, they released their debut self-titled album, and the single Breakdown became the band's first hit. More albums followed, including 1979's Damn the Torpedoes, 1991's Into the Great Wide Open, and the iconic The Last DJ, released in 2002. In 1988, Petty got together with Bob Dylan, George Harrison, Jeff Lynne, and Roy Orbison to form the supergroup The Traveling Wilburys. The Wilburys gave us songs such as Handle With Care and End of the Line. Through it all, Tom Petty stayed true to the music and gave us all many moments of pure joy. And now it is truly the end of the line. Rest well, Tom. Your music will never die.
The U.S. government missed yet another opportunity to stand on the right side of history Friday when it voted against a UN Human Rights Council resolution condemning the use of state-sanctioned executions to stifle speech, curtail basic human freedoms, and punish consensual sexual relationships. The resolution, which ultimately passed, was submitted by Benin, Belgium, Costa Rica, France, Mexico, the Republic of Moldova, Mongolia, and Switzerland, as part of an ongoing attempt by the international community to stop countries like the U.S. from murdering their citizens. The resolution highlighted the fact that, quote, frequently poor and economically vulnerable persons and foreign nationals are disproportionately subjected to the death penalty. The laws carrying the death penalty are used against persons exercising their rights to freedom of expression, thought, conscience, religion, and peaceful assembly and association, and that persons belonging to religious and ethnic minorities are disproportionately represented among those sentences to the death penalty. It went on to urge, quote, states that have not yet abolished the death penalty to ensure that it is not imposed as a sanction for specific forms of conduct such as apostasy, blasphemy, adultery, and consensual same-sex relations, end quote. The U.S. joined Botswana, Burundi, Egypt, Ethiopia, Bangladesh, China, India, Iraq, Japan, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates in opposing the resolution on the grounds that it is infringed on a state's sovereign rights to kill its citizens as it sees fit.
In the wake of last Sunday's massacre in Las Vegas, House Speaker Paul Ryan has removed a bill from consideration by Congress that would have eased restrictions on gun silencers. The bill known as the SHARE Act was introduced last month and argues that gun silencers could lessen the hearing damage to hunters caused by the sound of gunshots. Opponents of the bill have stated that silencers would make the impact of mass shootings, like the one on Sunday, much worse as the sound of the gunfire alerts possible victims. Other versions of the bill were attempted under the Obama administration but stalled in Congress. Pro-gun advocates had hoped that the bill would pass this time and Donald Trump would have been sure to sign it. Another bill that the NRA hopes will come up for a vote soon in the House would allow persons with a concealed weapons permit to carry their firearms across state lines, even to states that do not allow concealed weapons. That bill has yet to be scheduled for discussion or a vote in the House.
Iraq veteran Taylor Winston was labeled a hero after his courageous acts during the Las Vegas shooting this past weekend. As soon as the gunman opened fire on the dense crowd below, Winston immediately went and tried to help the victims get to safety and drive some wounded to a hospital. He had run to a field that had many white trucks, and among the first few he checked, there was one that had a key still inside. Winston stole the truck and used it to bring 20 to 30 injured and severely wounded victims to a nearby hospital. Winston had enlisted in the military when he was 17 and was honorably discharged as a sergeant in 2011. He says that he thinks his military experience aided him in the situation. There was a lot of bravery and courageous people out there, but I'm glad that I could call them my country folk, he had said.
Custodians at three Portland elementary schools came to work on Monday to find the schools vandalized with racist messages. Lincoln Park Elementary, Mill Park Elementary, and Ventura Park Elementary, all in the David Douglas School District, were the targets of a pair of men who were seen on surveillance footage scrawling messages such as Heil Hitler, 666, as well as a number of racial slurs. The men were also seen smashing eggs on school buildings. It is believed that the pair are also responsible for the vandalism at Menlo Park School last week, where the same kind of messages were found and an outside porta potty was set on fire. The messages were covered up before children arrived to school for class.
And now we hear from our friends at Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections.
I think it's important to listen to Native people when it comes to climate change and environmental issues because this isn't new to us. We have, since before 1492, known that protecting the environment is important and critical to the generations that come.
That's Mary Catherine Nagel, a lawyer, playwright, and citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. She was studying environmental law at Tulane University in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina hit. She saw the connection between the storm and climate change, which can cause stronger hurricanes. And she says people have destroyed many coastal wetlands that once served as storm buffers.
When we live out of balance with the land, when we inflict violence and harm on the land, that threatens the viability of the generations not yet born.
But Nagel still hopes people can change. She wants to create a cultural shift by telling stories about environmental injustice. For example, she wrote a play set during Hurricane Katrina. It follows two Native American law students who grapple with the causes and effects of climate change in their communities.
But as a playwright, I do feel it's very important for Americans to hear about climate change from a Native perspective.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Seven students at a New Jersey high school have been suspended following the assault of a 14-year-old transgender student last week. Kylie Perez was attacked by another student in a hallway at Eastside High School in Newark. Officials say that the student who beat Perez and those who recorded it have been suspended. Newark school officials also say the suspended students will have disciplinary hearings this week. The Essex County Prosecutor's Office has said the incident is being investigated as a possible bias crime, but no charges have been filed. Perez has stated that they're not going to let it fade away and says, quote, "I'm going to make sure that people know that trans lives, every life, matters." Christian Fusarino, executive director of Garden State Equality, a New Jersey LGBTQ+ advocacy organization, said, quote, "This type of incident is unacceptable and we must expand our anti-bullying work in schools."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Native community in Gallup, New Mexico, came out to support the family of Lisa Romero Muniz, who was one of the more than 50 people who died in Sunday's mass shooting in Las Vegas, Nevada.
And I said, "What does that mean?" And I said, "That means her children."
A vigil was held Monday night in Gallup. Caroline June Salone was a longtime co-worker with Romero Muniz, who was recently a discipline secretary at a local high school.
She was a very beautiful person, inside and out. Her personality is just something that attracts you to her. You look forward to seeing her every day, just sitting in her office. It's just like you've known her your whole life.
She also had a connection with students, says high school junior Abigail Littlefield, who says they met when the student was in elementary school.
Miss Lisa meant everything to me. She always helped me without, like, really doing that much. All she had to do was give me a hug, and I felt like 20 times better than I did before. She was like my second mom. She was my mom at school.
The school district says the loss has shocked and saddened the educational community. Gallup-McKinley County School Board President Charles Long.
It made a great impact on communities and even communities that are not in our school district. And I think what happened is a senseless killing. We don't understand why people do that. Maybe if we had a better sense of why they do it, maybe there's a way to prevent things from happening like that.
Long says right now they're working to support the family and community and begin the healing process. Meanwhile, police continue the investigation into the attack by a 64-year-old suspect who opened fire on people attending a concert on the Las Vegas Strip. The National Science Foundation has awarded Black Hills State University a grant of more than $700,000 to expand computer science education in South Dakota. The grant's lead author wants to work with schools in Indian Country, as South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Jeremy Ludeman reports.
Ben Saylor directs the Sanford Science Education Center at BHSU. He says he received positive feedback at the South Dakota Indian Education Summit about the Exploring Computer Science curriculum.
I talked to administrators and representatives from schools that are on American Indian reservations or near American Indian reservations. And there was a lot of interest among people at that summit, and there's great interest within our project to engage those schools.
Lessons in the program include coding, app development, and web design. Saylor says 22 high schools in South Dakota are already on board. He says the goal is to implement the curriculum at 20 additional schools in the state over the next 3 years. The funds are meant to bring computer science opportunities to rural and traditionally underserved areas. For National Native News, I'm Jeremy Ludeman.
Native Americans rallied Monday night in Kansas City at Arrowhead Stadium as the Kansas City Chiefs played the Washington football team. Organizers say the rally was to educate the public about Native people and draw attention to Native American mascots. People held signs, which included the words, "Not Your Mascot," and "Rally Against Racism." Native groups say Indian mascots, including those in the National Football League, perpetuate negative stereotypes of Native people and have harmful impacts on Native youth. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Portland has entered the nationwide race to be the next city to host a major Amazon facility. The city will offer the giant internet retailer the opportunity to purchase land in the downtown U.S. Post Office Distribution Center for its proposed new nationwide headquarters. The site will be included in a list of other available properties in the region that will be submitted to Amazon by Greater Portland, Inc. GPI is a regional economic development partnership focused on attracting new employers to the area. According to Portland Housing Bureau Director Kurt Krager, the offer will not include any special incentives. Sean Ullman, a spokesperson for Prosper Portland, confirmed that the site will be included in GPI's submission to Amazon. The Seattle-based company created enormous national interest on September 7th when they issued a request for proposal for a new site for a second headquarters. The company said that they are planning to spend over $5 billion to build an 8 million square foot facility. The second headquarters will eventually grow to hold a total of 50,000 employees.
This fall, Portland's Urban Forestry Program will host 3 citywide tree giveaways in Cully, Centennial, and Hazelwood neighborhoods. All Portlanders are welcome. There's a limit of 2 trees per household, and the trees are for planting in yards, not in containers or in the sidewalk as street trees. The free trees range from medium to large in size, and the species include native, conifer, evergreen, and deciduous. There will be an hourly demonstration of how to plant a tree at a giveaway. The free tree will come with a bag of mulch and educational materials. Program staff will provide tree delivery and planting for Portlanders with a limited mobility provided they register in advance.
Learn to love me, assemble the way. Now, today, tomorrow, and always. My only weakness is a list of crimes.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report with KBOO's Tom Flynn as he speaks with members of Youth Ending Slavery. Following that, it's Transpositive PDX at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for a mostly sunny day with temperatures in the low to mid-70s. East of the Cascades and Hood River, you can expect a sunny day with temperatures in the mid-60s. On this day in 1990, East and West Germany were reunited as one nation. At the conclusion of World War II, the country had been divided into occupation zones managed by the US, the UK, France, and the Soviet Union. The occupation of West Germany ended in 1955, but the Soviet Union controlled East Germany as a satellite state for another 35 years. The quote of the day is from former West German Chancellor Willy Brandt, who said that the German reunification, quote, "Now it belongs together, we'll grow together," end quote.
And now, KBOO's Al Kahn has a few words about the recent NFL protests and the American flag.
Okay. The argument keeps going on and on over the NFL players taking the knee during the national anthem in protest over the many deaths of young black people at the hands of the police in this country. And also the failure of the justice system to punish the officers who have killed these people whose only crime was being black. This protest has also infuriated many people. They call it disrespect for the flag and the military. Now, as a veteran myself, I believe that when I served, I promised to defend the Constitution, including the First Amendment, meaning I serve to defend the right to take the knee or not take the knee. It's a personal choice. So I find no disrespect to this protest in any way whatsoever. But I have looked in other ways the flag is disrespected all the time. So at this time, I would like to invite all you good patriotic people to look at the United States Code, Title 36, Chapter 10, as I have. This is the flag code, so buckle up, Buttercup. It's going to be a bumpy ride. Let's start with Article 175, Section A. The flag should not be displayed on any float in any parade except from a staff. Yep, all your Stars and Stripes parade floats on the 4th of July. You shouldn't be doing it. Let's move to Article 176. There's lots to see here. Section C states the flag should never be carried flat or horizontally, but always aloft and free. So those giant flags you see at the football field, you know, that they put all over the whole size of the field, well, sorry, but that's a no-no. Article D. Article D states the flag should never be used as wearing apparel. So your flag t-shirts, hats, bedspreads, curtains, underwear, bathing suits, whatever. Whoops. Can't be doing it. Article H says the flag should never be used as a receptacle for receiving, holding, or carrying, or delivering anything. So your flag beer cans and plastic cups, they have to go. Article I states the flag should never be used for advertising purposes in any matter whatsoever. It should not be embroidered on such articles as cushions or handkerchiefs and the like. Printed or otherwise impressed on paper napkins or boxes or anything that is designed for temporary use and discard. So the paper plates with the flag on them that you buy at the Dollar Tree, and then you plop your potato salad and barbecue chicken on them, as well as the flag napkins you use to wipe the sauce and the chicken grease off your face and then toss in the trash or burn in the campfire. Yeah, I think you get the idea. And did you even know that you can buy toilet paper on eBay adorned with the flag? Yes, for $7.77, you can use the American flag for toilet paper. Funny thing, in the entire code, the only thing I saw about requiring somebody to stand for the national anthem is regarding active duty military, where it says persons in uniform should render the military salute at the first note of the anthem and retain this position until the last note. I sincerely hope this information will enlighten you on what it is to truly disrespect the flag and what is not. I'm Al Kahn, and I thank you for your attention.
Last week, it was announced the Washington Department of Ecology had denied the water permit for the Longview Coal Terminal. This brought a 7-year fight against the project to successful conclusion. KBOO's Ray Bodwell spoke with Jasmine Zimmer Stuckey of the Columbia Riverkeeper about that fight and where the next battles lie.
I'm speaking with Jasmine Zimmer Stuckey of the Columbia Riverkeeper, who has agreed to talk to us today and tell us about what most of us perceive as a tremendous success in the fight against the Longview Coal Terminal. Jasmine, first of all, thanks so much for coming in. And second of all, please share with us the good news and what this really means.
Absolutely. So for 7 years, the folks in Longview and throughout the Pacific Northwest have been fighting to stop what would have been the largest coal export terminal in North America. And last week, the state of Washington handed that company, Millennium Bulk Terminals, a permit denial for their water quality certification, effectively, you know, ending the project.
And I love the quote that I read. In fact, it was on your website, but the quote from the State of Washington Department of Ecology, that the terminal would have caused significant and unavoidable harm to 9 environmental areas: air quality, vehicle traffic, vessel traffic, rail capacity, rail safety, noise pollution, social and community resources, cultural resources, and tribal resources, end quote. That sounds like it's kind of final and irrefutable. But as, you know, folks who've watched the Dakota Access Pipeline and Keystone Pipeline come back from the dead, I was curious what your comfort level here is that that's the case with Longview.
People should certainly be celebrating this victory. It was something that, you know, from the very beginning, this project had unprecedented public opposition, and you carried that through all the way through the end. The company has indicated that they are going to appeal. The appeal hasn't been filed yet, and there are still a couple of other permits that were in the hopper. when this permit denial came down last week from the state of Washington. And again, the company has indicated that they want to actually proceed with those processes, even though they're essentially a dead-end zombie project at the moment. So I think people should be celebrating, and we may have to come to another hearing or two, or have one or two more public comment periods to really make sure that every single nail in the coal export coffin is hammered in.
This battle's been going on for 7 years, right? And so, you know, when I think about the resources that these monstrous energy companies have and the legal resources they have, and then I think about the Riverkeeper, obviously you folks didn't do this alone, but it must have been quite a team effort, and it really must be a testimony to the legal resources that you have. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the Riverkeeper did not fight this project alone. It took not just a village, it took the entire Pacific Northwest. Folks may remember that there were 7 proposed coal export terminals at the peak of this flood, and now, you know, we're down to just one remaining one in British Columbia. We quickly formed a coalition called the Power Pass Coal Coalition, and that includes, you know, groups on the ground in Longview, partners in Montana who are fighting the extraction side of things, folks along the rail lines, and groups like Earth Justice and Crag Law Center who helped, you know, represent us in court and, you know, in all of these various legal permitting processes to make sure that the people's voice was heard loud and clear.
Well, for the moment, let's be real optimistic that this is indeed dead.
Absolutely.
And so the next question comes to mind is, obviously, the Riverkeeper never rests. And so my question for you is, what are the next big threats on the horizon? The ones that come to my mind are Kalama and the monstrous methanol site, but also the ongoing ecological disaster in Hanford. And I'm curious to get your thoughts on both of them.
I think that the next big fight for the Pacific Northwest and folks who have, you know, a strong desire to fight climate change is taking on fracked gas in the same way that we've taken on coal and oil and largely won. Projects like the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal in Coos Bay, the fracked gas to methanol refinery in Kalama, the LNG project in Tacoma, these are huge facilities that will, if they're built, lock our region into fracked gas consumption for the next, you know, 5 decades, because big consumers, they shift or they set the market tone for the rest of us little guys. So we really need to be as strong, as loud, and as insistent that the fracked gas industry get out of the Pacific Northwest, just like we have been with coal and oil.
The in particular, the Jordan Cove one, it's a little bit off of the radar screen up here in Portland. And so what's the status on that one? I have to confess I'm not really fully up to date on that.
Yeah, there is a public comment period open right now, and folks can go online to Rogue Riverkeeper or Rogue Climate to get the latest information. It's definitely, it would be the largest, Oregon's largest source of carbon pollution if it were built, and we have a chance to stop it. But that time frame is right now. The fracked gas industry has been far more successful at lobbying our politicians, at lobbying our utilities, and essentially tricking them into thinking that they are the cleaner alternative to coal or to oil. And, you know, increasingly the science is refuting that and saying, you know, this, you are not the clean energy solution. The clean energy solutions are wind and solar.
Obviously, the battle goes on, but this first one is a great victory, mm-hmm. and I congratulate you and all of the groups that came together so successfully. What would you, you know, urge listeners to do who want to be involved and make their voices heard? And also, how can they help out the Riverkeeper directly?
Mm-hmm. I would encourage folks to educate themselves on fracked gas. It is going to be the future fight that we're all going to be in together. And I would encourage people to come out to public hearings, to submit comments when groups ask you to. One of the things that was consistently, you know, powerful about the coal export fight is that folks showed up. This campaign, the coal export campaign, has been a testament to how many people continue show up and continue to show up. the opposition to these projects has been overwhelming, and the coal companies have felt it, and we've set the bar high.
Thank you so much for your time, and thank you so much to you and all of the Riverkeeper for your tremendous efforts in protecting one of the great natural resources in the area.
Thank you.
For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Next, we hear from our colleagues at H2O Radio. It's This Week in Water. Glub, glub.
The Colorado River sues Colorado. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
Recovery operations in Puerto Rico are still running into significant gridlock as of October 1st. The Hill reports that problems persist in moving items such as food, water, medicine, and other critical materials out of the port in San Juan.
People are having to spend up to an entire day just to obtain one necessity like food or fuel. About 20 miles from the capital, locals lined up to fill containers near a PVC pipe that trickles water from a hillside spring, according to USA Today.
Even before the hurricane, however, clean drinking water in Puerto Rico was a major problem. In May, the National Resources Defense Council issued a report concluding that the island suffered the worst rate of drinking water violations of any state or territory in the nation.
Nearly 70% of the water system had high levels of contaminants, including volatile organic compounds.
Now people are worried that winds and lashing rains from the hurricane may have washed toxins into waterways from coal ash dumps.
Grist reports that the island has 40 toxic dumps of ash from burning coal to generate power. These open-air dumps contain lead, arsenic, and other chemicals that can contaminate sources of drinking water.
If there is any silver lining to this immense disaster, it may be that Puerto Rico could rebuild its water and power generation infrastructure on sustainable and renewable sources.
Environmental laws are failing to protect the environment. That's what some people in Colorado are saying, and they want to change that by treating ecosystems the same way as corporations.
Last week, a lawsuit was filed in Denver claiming that the Colorado River should be accorded the status of a person with rights to exist and to thrive independent of human ownership or use.
The Boulder Weekly reports that the suit is being brought in the name of the river against the state of Colorado. But because the river cannot speak, members of the Deep Green Resistance, an environmental activist group, are listed as guardians or next friends acting on the river's behalf.
The notion that a river has rights of its own may be new in the U.S., but not in other countries. Last week in Australia, the legislature in Victoria passed the Yarra River Protection Act that treats the river as one integrated living natural entity.
And in India, both the Ganges and Yamuna rivers have legal status.
Officials with the state of Colorado have not yet responded to the suit, but those opposed to the rights of nature approach say that it would unravel the current water rights system that has existed for 150 years.
Imagine that 70% of the U.S. demand for electricity could be met by a source that's non-polluting and works whether the sun is shining or the wind is blowing.
A new technology based upon water evaporation could make that a reality, according to a team from Columbia University.
They've developed an evaporation engine which works by using muscle-like bands that expand and contract with tiny changes in humidity. As the bands get wetter, they grow, then shrink. As they dry. The energy from the expansion and contraction has been shown to power a light bulb or move a model car.
As reported in Quartz, the scientists have calculated the average rate of evaporation from inland waterways in the U.S. and have projected that it could be a massive source of renewable energy.
Scientists are in awe and a bit fearful as a new study shows that after the 2011 tsunami in Japan, nearly 300 species of marine life crossed the Pacific Ocean and arrived on the west coast from Alaska to California.
The BBC reports that creatures such as mussels, starfish, and many other invertebrates rafted across the ocean, often on pieces of plastic debris.
The tsunami washed things like coolers, fishing boats, boats and even docks into the sea, and with the living creatures attached, they made a journey of over 6,000 miles.
The research says that the presence of plastic, fiberglass, and other materials that do not decompose made the rafting possible for the animals.
But while the journey of these marine hitchhikers is remarkable, it also raises concerns about the risk of invasive species. As storms become more intense due to climate change, that threat is larger than it's ever been. And finally, last Friday was International Coffee Day, and many chains were offering free cups of Joe to celebrate because we Americans, we love our Java. According to market research firm Euromonitor, Americans drink more coffee than soda, tea, and juice combined.
But is coffee good for you? That answer seems to change as fast as you can say grande half-calf soy no-foam latte. And in fact, there were two stories out this week that complicate whether we should drink up or worry.
First, the good news. A new study of people who drank a minimum of 4 cups a day had a higher chance of living longer compared to folks who rarely drank the stuff. And in case you're wondering, it didn't matter if the coffee were full strength or decaffeinated.
The new finding supports previous research that showed coffee could also reduce the risk of many conditions, including type 2 diabetes, liver disease, colorectal cancer, and Alzheimer's.
Now that bad news. According to the AP, a lawsuit filed in 2010 by the Council for Education and Research on Toxics resumed this week in Los Angeles.
Its primary complaint is that coffee retailers such as Starbucks, Dunkin' Donuts, Seattle's Best, Whole Foods, and several convenience stores violated the California Safe Drinking Water and Toxic Enforcement Act, also known as Proposition 65. That law requires them to post warnings about chemicals known to cause cancer or that have reproductive toxicity.
The compound at issue is the carcinogen acrylamide that forms in some foods when they're cooked at high temperatures by frying, roasting, or baking. We're talking things ranging from French fries to dark toast and, of course, coffee.
The industry has acknowledged the presence of acrylamide, but asserts it is at harmless levels, which are outweighed by coffee's benefits.
The outcome of the suit that's been brewing for years could determine if there's a wake-up call about to hit the coffee industry. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Water quality experts will present the latest science and research in the field at WQTC in Portland, November 12th through 16th. Learn more at awwa.org/WQTC.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. In three separate class action lawsuits, Menards workers are accusing the company of essentially stealing overtime wages by violating the Fair Labor Standards Act. The class action suits accuse Menards of not paying legally required overtime and of forcing workers to work off the clock for all breaks. The suits also assert that workers aren't getting paid for company-required meetings. This alleged company-wide policy affects hundreds of locations and tens of thousands of workers at Menards retail stores, distribution centers, and manufacturing facilities. Menards workers say they put in as many as 50 hours a week for years without getting paid all the overtime pay they earned. The suit seeks compensation for all Menards workers similarly situated. In addition to these lawsuits, Menards is facing an OSHA investigation and NLRB complaints on other violations of labor law. Lori Mowry is a former Missouri Menards worker fired after complaining about safety issues at the store in Farmington, Missouri. She was injured in a fall she says was caused by sweeping machines that left water on the floor. She had complained to management about the safety hazard before she herself fell and was injured. She also complained to OSHA. Lori says she also found Menards wasn't paying her in full for her work, and she has no doubt that Menards is doing the same thing to other workers.
It's absolutely happening to all the employees. A lot of managers are required to work 12 to 15-hour days. They get 2 10-minute breaks a day. If they go on a third break, they're not getting paid for it. I have a complaint with OSHA that is going up against Menards, and then I also have a complaint with the NLRB because I brought up unions and I brought them up a couple times in communication with general management at the store.
Mowry encourages all Menards workers to speak up about these labor law violations.
Former employees at Menards, or maybe even current employees, and just employees in general, if they find that their employer is doing this to them, speak up and make sure that they're heard. I think the more noise you make, that the better chance we have of making this stop. John Menard seems to get by with things that it doesn't make any sense to me how a person can get by with the things that he does, with the way the employees are treated, the things that he does that are just wrong.
Wynn is America's multimedia news voice for workers.
We need to make more money. You know, what they're paying us, the greedy corporation, they just want to pay us what they want to pay us. And it's not right.
We are sick of an economy and a democracy that are rigged against us.
Support Wynn's worker news mission at workersindependentnews.com. You've been listening to Wynn, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
Now a look at this day in labor history.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1935. That was the year that San Diego hosted the California Pacific International Exposition, where President Franklin Delano Roosevelt spoke the most memorable words about the rights of workers to organize. The goal of the exposition was to showcase San Diego and to boost the local economy, which had fallen on hard times during the Great Depression. The exposition was held in Balboa Park. Exhibits included history, science, industry, and culture. To prepare for the expo, improvements were made to the park paid for by the Works Progress Administration. The WPA was a New Deal-era program designed to put people back to work on public infrastructure projects. The expo kicked off in May and ran for 377 days with a break during the winter months. More than 7 million people visited the park for the expo. Two of those visitors was President Roosevelt and his wife Eleanor. As part of his trip, the president gave a speech to 60,000 people at Balboa Stadium. Earlier that year, the president had signed the Wagner Act, otherwise known as the National Labor Relations Act, which guaranteed private sector workers the right to join and form a union. The president spent part of his expo speech celebrating that achievement. He declared, quote, "A changing civilization has raised new problems with respect to the relationship between the employer and the employed. It is now beyond partisan controversy that it is a fundamental individual right of a worker to associate himself with other workers and to bargain collectively with his employer." President Roosevelt went on to acknowledge, quote, "New laws in themselves do not bring a millennium. The passage of the law helped to launch a new wave of union organizing across U.S. industry."
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Al Kahn, Ray Bodwell, Jasmine Moneymaker, Tom Flynn, and Isabel Cochran. The producer is Zelos Marchant. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seaway. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jasmine.
And I'm Kyle, and coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul Rowland welcomes your calls. At 9, The Politics of Living looks at the health of workers in nuclear facilities, the effects of pesticides, living with bipolar disorder, plus the music of Deborah Giannini. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Bike Show examines the way cycling and transportation affect our everyday lives. KBOO keeps you informed and can get you, and you can get involved even after a fall membership drive. Call 877-500-5266 or go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Good evening, KBOO listeners. This is our interview format here, and we're lucky tonight to have two young people. First of all, Emma Christensen, president, and Gwen Kalishewski, director of communications for a group called Youth Ending Slavery. Gwen, did I get that right this time?
Yes.
Sorry about that. Okay, Youth Ending Slavery. That's a big name. Emma, what is YES, Youth Ending Slavery?
Youth Ending Slavery is a 501c3 nonprofit based in Portland, Oregon. We are entirely youth-led, and our mission is to combat human trafficking through spreading awareness about the issue and empowering youth to be advocates for change.
What's the origin of YES?
YES actually started as a club at St. Mary's. Allison Nason was the founder of this club. She was very passionate about the issue of human trafficking and decided she wanted to do something about it. It later became a 501c3 nonprofit when Claire McLeod, when she was president, she decided to file for 501c3 status in 2014.
Gwen, you're talking about slavery. Isn't slavery dead?
Slavery just exists in different forms than it did. Often people aren't aware that it's actually still around us. It just doesn't look the same as it did historically. There's many different forms, such as sex trafficking and labor trafficking and bonded labor. It's just more underground, and it's just exists in many different ways, but it's still there. It's still like the buying and selling of people for profit.
Now, I heard earlier that there's a survey on your website that tests a person's slavery footprint. What is it, and why would people want to take it?
This is actually a quiz that you can take that takes into account many different aspects in your life, such as how many items you own, how much clothing you own, what type of food you eat, how many electronics you buy, and all sorts of other factors. And it produces a rough estimate of how many slaves may be working for you, which can be very eye-opening.
So, Emma, you've taken this survey. How many slaves work for you?
If I remember correctly, it was approximately around 30 slaves working for me, which is a very eye-opening statistic.
Right.
That's haunting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm going to take this footprint test here.
Yeah.
But I should mention, I met Emma and Gwen in conjunction with some work that KBOO News is doing, producing a series coming up in about 2 weeks on the sex industry in Portland. And they are relating to that in connection with this issue of trafficking. Gwen, what's trafficking? How does that relate to the sex industry?
So trafficking is the exploitation of people for profit, being paid unfair wages, having unsafe conditions, being paid nothing at all, being trapped in any sort of environment, being coerced to do something. Basically, trafficking goes hand in hand with slavery. It's the buying and selling of people for profit. And one of the huge forms of trafficking is sex trafficking, selling people for sex.
Why do you think there's a growing interest in youth wanting to learn more about human trafficking?
It's an issue that hits very close to home for youth because the average age for youth entering into sex trafficking specifically is 12 years old. So for me, that's how I started getting involved in the issue, was because it was something that just hit really close to home and something that I felt that I wanted to be more involved with.
You guys, or does your group offer some solutions to trafficking? How do you address this problem?
Yeah, there are many different solutions that we can look into. A big one is altering culture, because there are many different issues that can lead someone to be more vulnerable to being trafficked. And so just by supporting victims and educating about the issue, spreading awareness and altering culture, these are all different things that can lead someone to be less vulnerable and less likely to go into human trafficking or to go back into the life. Another important thing is decriminalizing the victims. Victims are oftentimes seen as criminals for if we're talking specifically about sex work and sex trafficking. And so decriminalizing the victims is crucial so that they don't end up taking the blame for something that is not their fault. Education, as I said earlier, is also very important. So people will be less likely to go into trafficking as well as go back into it.
And there are some reports in 2014 that suggested that Portland is a hub for human trafficking. Do you consider this to be true, or do you think it's average for a large city?
No, it's definitely true. Portland has the most strip clubs per capita than any other city, and this is often a legal front for illegal sex trafficking. They're often used. There's backroom sort of tradings of young people. And then also our proximity to I-5 makes it easy for people to transport, often sex, people being transported for sex.
Well, we're living in a world of social media. We seem to be encountering that phrase every day here at KBOO and in the news and everywhere I go. How is the emergence of social media affecting trafficking and the sex industry, as far as you guys know?
I think that social media is a double-edged sword in that it can provide people with more resources for the good or for the bad. Social media can connect us. It can help us educate people about different issues, including human trafficking. But it can also be a place for human trafficking to take place underground, which makes it really hard to see the issue. There are different websites such as Backpage where people are being trafficked, and it's just a very underground industry. So the internet is both bringing the issue to light but also making it more underground in some regards.
Since human trafficking is underground, how can the common citizen identify it and do anything to deter it or stop it?
Definitely, I think just going back to root issues, to addressing the vulnerabilities, especially of young people not having a support system, that can kind of stop it at the root. But just making sure that there are aftercare facilities for survivors of sex trafficking and other forms of trafficking to support these people so they're not inclined to go back into the life.
Some of your solutions and your organization itself must require funding. How do you fund your work, and do you have any events coming up that our listeners might be interested in attending?
Yeah, definitely. So most of our funding comes from grants, donations, and also fundraisers that we put on as an organization and through our chapters, through selling t-shirts and different things like that at our events. We recently had our annual Walk to End Slavery on September 30th, and we are going to hold our annual 5K, which is held by the Forest Grove chapter, or put on by the Forest Grove chapter. That'll be this spring, and we're also planning on holding a documentary screening in the upcoming month in November, and we're also planning on holding a gala event coming up.
And Yes gives talks about modern day slavery in schools. How would someone be able to arrange such a talk?
You're able to contact us through our website, but really if you just send us an email about wanting us to come into your school, we'll be more than happy to.
Our email is youthendingslavery@gmail.com. Mm-hmm.
I would mention on the website is the list of schools that you guys have presented at. It's quite lengthy, very impressive. Do you find that the school establishments, the school boards, and the principals and the teachers support your entry into the schools and the discussion of sensitive item issues like this?
Yeah, this issue really hits really close to home with students from, you know, high school age students and middle school. So we've gotten a lot of support from high schools, middle schools, and colleges over the years with presentations, which has helped us a lot.
Right.
And does Yes look into modern day slavery and human trafficking in other countries as well as America?
Definitely. We look into different types of human trafficking. We focus mostly on sex trafficking and labor trafficking, which both take place all over the world. So we like to use a broader or take a broader perspective and look into other countries as well.
How did you get interested? Let me ask you first, Gwen, how did you get interested in this subject? This seems like something out of your realm of experience and knowledge, and yet you're deeply involved. How did you get involved?
It's just, Yes is such a special organization because it's really youth having a voice for such an important issue, and I became involved in it after attending the Walk to End Slavery just because I saw how empowering it was to be able to have to take action as a young person. And like many people, I think, involved in this cause, it's something that's really close to us as young girls that we are lucky enough not to have been subjected to specifically sex trafficking, because that's a huge thing for people our age. And so wanting to make sure that we can help as many people as we can not be subjected to it, because it could have been us.
Emma, what's your story?
When I was a freshman, I went to Human Rights Club regularly, and one day the topic of discussion was human trafficking, and it was something I didn't know a whole lot before. It's not the type of thing that's often taught in school, so I didn't have much knowledge about it. And we watched a video, and it was about a girl who was my age, and she had been coerced into human trafficking, and so it hit very close to home for me, because I recognized that I could have been in a similar situation if I had, but I fortunately was not put into that situation, but it just hit very close to home for me. And I later also attended the Walk to End Slavery my freshman year, and that spring decided to apply to be on the board of directors.
Does Yes do any work with people who have gotten out of the life of human trafficking?
As an organization, we don't have the capacity to work directly with victims of human trafficking because we focus more on the education aspect. However, we have worked with many survivors of human trafficking through other events, and we've partnered with them. We've had survivors speak at our past events. For example, last or the Yes Walk 2016, we had Rebecca Bender come speak, and she is a survivor. And so she spoke at our event. We've had other survivors speak at our events, and we've partnered with numerous other organizations in the Portland area that work directly with victims.
Do you feel that a 12-year-old girl who experiences trafficking can recover from that and lead a productive and happy life somehow?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely different for each person, but I think that the aftercare is so crucial because we can't just let survivors slip through the cracks. It's not like you're out and you're completely fine. You have to like build back that support. And so I think, yeah, I think it you can recover, but it takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of support and a lot of people caring about the issue and caring about the people.
I would just add, KBOO has a local audience. We're a station here in Portland, but we also have people listening to us on the web, on the internet, and around the world, a few. This group has chapters. How many chapters do you have?
We currently have 13 chapters.
And they're where?
All over Oregon and Washington, and we're looking to expand.
They're looking to expand. So, somebody in upstate New York who wants to create a chapter, get a hold of Emma, the president. And Emma, how would they reach you?
Send us an email or submit a form. We have a form to apply to be a chapter on our website, which is youthendingslavery.org. And so you can check that out. It's a pretty easy application, and then we'll get in contact with you and help you through the process. So just reach out to us via email or submit the application, and we'll be happy to work with you.
Sometimes the world seems like a very dark place in the future, and it may be, but when I see these two young people sitting here and talking like this, I feel some hope.
Some optimism. We definitely need a lot of it.
We need a lot of it. So thank you for your work.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming to KBOO tonight, and you will hear them again in our series on the sex industry in Portland in about mid-October, folks. Thank you.
You have my heart, we'll never be words apart. Maybe in magazines, but you'll still be my star, baby. Cause in the dark, you can't see shiny cars. And that's when you need me there. With you, I'll always share. Because when the sun shines,